event itself is actually the weekend of July 16th. Anyway, for more information, baamboston.org.
You're invited to participate in a public communal reading of Frederick Douglass's remarkable speech, The Meaning of the 4th of July for the Negro. Next Thursday, July 1st at 12 noon on the Boston Common at the corner of Park and Beacon Streets. If it rains, the meeting will take place inside the State House. It's a communal reading of an abridged version of Douglass's iconic 1852 speech and its significance for the present day. The public is invited to join the reading. It's sponsored by Community Change, Inc. and a variety of other organizations. Visit communitychangeinc.org or call 617-523-0555 for more information.
And Clean Water Action Boston is sponsoring a gubernatorial energy and environment forum next Tuesday, 6 p.m. in Boston. All gubernatorial candidates were invited, but so far only the only confirmed participants are Governor Deval Patrick and Dr. Jill Stein of the Green Rainbow Party. The event is free and open to the public. It's next Tuesday, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Old South Meeting House, 310 Washington Street in downtown Boston.
The Honduran Resistance will honor the martyrs and victims of the ongoing repression in Honduras due to the coup that took place a year ago, June 28th. The event will take place this Sunday at 4 p.m. at City Hall in Chelsea. All peace and justice-loving people are invited to share an afternoon of solidarity, poetry, and music against the violations of human rights that continue in Honduras. The event is free and open to all. That is 4 p.m. this Sunday at Chelsea City Hall.
And A Sea Change, Imagine a World Without Fish, will be screened this Saturday from 7 to 9 p.m. at the First Church Somerville, 80 College Ave near Davis Square. The film is about ocean acidification, climate change, and solutions. All are welcome.
Good. Finally, you might have heard on Free Speech Radio News tonight, many, many people will be joining across the country in Hands Across the Sand this Saturday, which is tomorrow. It's a massive coordinated demonstration of support for clean energy. People will meet on beaches, join hands, and draw a metaphorical line in the sand against offshore drilling. Organizers hope to make Hands Across the Sand the largest demonstration against offshore drilling in history. Events are taking place tomorrow all over Massachusetts, especially on the Cape. In Boston, two events that I know of, one on Castle Island in South Boston, meet up at the gazebo on Head Island Causeway. People will spread out to William J. Day Boulevard and Fort Independence from there. Or Spectacle Island, you can take the ferry from Boston or Quincy and join hands at noon on the beach there. So for more information, including information about where in Massachusetts you can go tomorrow morning to join Hands Across the Sand events, visit handsacrossthesand.org. It is now 7:01 in the p.m., and you are listening to What's Left on WMBR in Cambridge. That is to say, you were listening to What's Left. The views and opinions that have been expressed on this program have been those of the participants and have not necessarily been those of the staff and management of WMBR, the Technology Broadcasting Corporation, or the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Now that I have suitably done all the events and everything else that you need, it will be time for something else that you need. Yes, Music for Human Beings is coming up in just a moment as they float into the studio. Please come back next week, and the struggle continues.
فمرحبا. مرحبا. Yes, مرحبا بكم في Music for Human. The bubbly water is delicious, and being with you is more delicious. This is Music for Human. I am Dr. Jalis Sakran, and I welcome you. Also with us this evening is Aurora, vocal therapist. Welcome, Aurora.
Thank you for having me on the show yet again, Dr. Jalis.
Aurora, it is so good both to have and to be had on the show.
Of course, and to embrace one another in this earthly communication, this non-physical and yet physical manifestation of voice and love.
Indeed. We also have returning with us Professor Levine. Professor, welcome.
Hello, and I should say that it is a very great pleasure to be you today.
It is a pleasure, of course, for us also to be you today.
And I should warn our listeners that if I sound somewhat sleepy or trance-like or dreamy, it is indeed because I am suffering the drastic effects of the jet lag, as I have been traveling recently and I've just returned from the Holy Land, the land full of many holes.
Indeed, indeed. And how did you find the land? Beyond
the holes.
Holiness.
Well, there are the projections of rock into the sky. There is the sea, the great sea. There are the expanses of desert. And there are many people claiming a connection with God there. Many, many people. But I saw God when I was there, and in fact, he had turned his face away from many of the people there.
You saw God in a vision, or I guess the distinction is vacuous.
Indeed, in fact, I am so sleepy at the moment that I am not sure that this itself is not a vision or a dream.
And while that sort of sleepiness can often straddle the border between extreme truth and extreme foolishness,
I think it can sort of open up leak open the deep oil well of wisdom, so that the oil of wisdom springs forth into the gulf of consciousness.
It can be a dangerous mixture. Not all wisdom is necessarily
helpful. Not all wisdom is wisdom.
Indeed. No, but I mean to say that it may be that some wisdom, if it is not overridden or if it does not embrace other wisdom, it can actually harm.
Yes, and that is something that I learned while there from the Baha'i faith. Baha'i.
And the Baha'i, so I'm not too familiar with their belief structure.
Well, I'm not intimately familiar with it, but after taking the guided tour of the shrine and the garden in Haifa, I was led to believe the basic tenet of the religion is that science and rationality must harmonize with religion, and that all religions contain some truth which can contribute to the welfare of humanity. So in that sense, it's a very New Age religion.
Well, and at the same time, the rigidity of our science and our logic structures can sometimes cloud our vision from the truth, can disallow us to believe something which we understand inherently.
That's exactly where this kind of discussion this show comes in, we can sort of soften the rigidity of science a bit. We can sort of smooth over those hard edges and make them a little warm and fuzzy the way we think they should be.
I mean, you know, I think that scientists are not the only ones that are guilty of being so closed-minded. I have met in my journeys students who were rejecting of any hypothesis that came out of the scientific establishment, and that is being simply as closed-minded, I think.
Right, of course, and we all know that many scientific truths are only metaphors. For example, Einstein postulated that all things are relative. Now, we know that physically that can't possibly be true, but yet we know that on a metaphorical level, all things indeed are relatives. All truths are relative. There is no absolute.
And yet, to extend Einstein's analogy, there must be some absolute if we are moving forward in an extremely unusual fashion. If we as society coagulate as we are intended, then perhaps we will reach the absolute truth and no longer have to think in relatives.
This idea that you have there, Aurora, that just as at the beginning of time, the universe, we hypothesize, was a single entity, a single point, that so it shall be at the end of time.
So where does that leave the watchmaker? I mean, I think Newton postulated that the world is sort of like a wind-up watch that once set in motion runs according to very particular rules. And then Darwin later came and said, well, that watchmaker was a blind watchmaker. He was a blind man living about 7,000 years ago. And my own observation, my own contribution is that the watch itself is often broken, or at least my watch is sometimes broken when I drop it on the floor.
Well, I believe that what all of us suffer from these days is an inherent knowledge, an understanding that we were once, all of us, every atom in our bodies, one single cohesive rock almost, a cohesive gas, a single point in space. And as spread out as we are right now, we feel a profound sense of loneliness, and we wish to become that point in space yet again.
Well, which is it? Is it a rock or a gas? Because I've often wondered which of those is the more basic element, is the original element. Were things originally in a gaseous form or in a rock form?
Well, rock or gas, I think the distinction between them is only the matter of interaction. And our matter of interaction here on Music for Human is speech. And if you'd like to interact with us in this manner, as other matter would, the number is 617-253-8810. Caller, marhaba. Also, we request that you turn down your radio or pull away from it, because interactions can occur which are unforeseen and undesired. Caller, are you with us?
Yeah, hi, this is Scott from Cambridge again. I'm sorry if I'm getting too frequent.
Welcome, Scott.
It is unlikely that you will become too frequent for us, Scott. Welcome.
Okay. Well, within those guidelines, no, you said that knowledge was suffering, or you very quickly passed over that knowledge was suffering. Where I was thinking that lack of not enough knowledge.
I don't remember hypothesizing knowledge being suffering, but I think that what I may plausibly believe is that ignorance can extreme ignorance may result in less suffering than partial knowledge.
Well, it is said that the rain is a manifestation of God's tears. I've often thought the reason God has to cry so often is because of his infinite knowledge of all that is, that somehow the universe itself is intrinsically tragic, and therefore deep knowledge of everything will lead one to feel pain and suffering to some degree.
Well, within a capacity to see God. Yeah.
I'd like to talk about that for a second, actually. I think it's such a profound sacrifice to be sad so often, as those tears would be made for our benefit so that we may reap the beautiful lush greens of the earth.
I mean, it is kind of interesting that in the Bible itself, in the Hebrew Bible, God is referred to often as being angry or merciful. So we have certain emotions being ascribed to God, but we never talk about whether God is happy or sad.
I believe that we are still, in this sense, children. Children can only imagine their parents being bad or very, very good.
But it
we
is
cannot
a kind
understand
of,
our parents' emotions or their motivations.
But it is a kind of striking idea, right? The idea that God created the universe, and yet God is very sad because of the tragic nature of existence.
And we could thrive off of God's sadness as we try to improve and become better.
I mean, to me, I would like to extend the possibility that the speech is all metaphorical, that we, being human, we shape our supreme deities in human clothes simply so that we may hypothesize understandings for their behavior.
Well, I mean, the question is, what sense can we understand God if we don't think of God as being something like a human being? And it's not clear whether the concept has any meaning if we let go of that.
Well, I think there are other concepts, like natural forces.
Happy forces or sad forces, though?
Perhaps. I mean, we do not invest time assigning happiness or sadness, except in jest, to things like gravity.
But doesn't that itself seem like a very cold universe, then?
Well, perhaps it's a cold universe that allows us to experience that intense fear or anxiety.
I'm not saying it is not useful. I'm saying that only perhaps it is simply that, a thing that is useful and not perhaps something that is not accurate.
Right, they do say that the broken clock is accurate at least, once a day if it's digital, twice a day if it's analog, because it doesn't distinguish between AM and PM.
Hmm. There are also stopwatches and watches that, clocks that have a shorter than 12-hour period.
I suppose a stopwatch could always be correct.
Or always incorrect.
At the same time, it's sort of profound, actually.
It sounds like a very interesting sign. It has been 0 seconds since I was thinking. Let's bring another voice in to share this unusual experience. Caller 2, marhaban.
Hello.
Yes, welcome, caller.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, this is Phil. I'm calling in. I'm just enjoying a nice afternoon of thin mints and skim milk. And I have not had the opportunity to listen to the show. I just figured I'd call in. I'm out of range, so I don't have the benefit of understanding the context of the conversation.
Well, Phil, I believe the thin mints can sometimes channel thoughts across great distances.
Mm.
And I wondered if while you were enjoying those thin mints, which I assume were bought from Girl Scouts.
Not directly, but indirectly,
they
ultimately
were
ultimately from the Girl Scout cartel.
Yes, from the Girl Scout cartel, and therefore benefiting many great charitable causes.
Mm.
So I wonder if by eating those thin mints you were perhaps able to gain some subconscious understanding of what we were discussing.
Mm. I actually misunderstood. I thought that Phil said he was enjoying a glass of skim milk.
With thin mints.
With thin mints.
Well, I was enjoying both. Yes.
You were enjoying skim milk.
I was enjoying skim milk.
Then I would like to ask, because this is something that I've wondered, if there is a skim water also.
Water without the fat.
Yeah. Or water without so much hydrogen.
Yeah, perhaps. I would like to enter a restaurant and order skim water.
Water light?
Light water. Diet water.
Well, and caller, I was, I also have a question regarding your choice of, snack, and this is not judgmental in any way, but why the skim milk as you are eating thin mints already?
As if the thinness of the skim milk compounded with the thinness of the mints may create some sort of dangerous paradox. I hadn't really given it so much thought, I suppose. I was just driven by my intuition as I approached the pantry. I opened the door and the thin mints appetized me. As skim milk was the only dairy option in my refrigerator, I defaulted. But I really should have pondered
Things could have been worse. It could have been soy milk, I suppose.
It could have been worse.
Well, in my mind, now let's draw this back into the discussion that that Phil is not... So, Phil, we were simply discussing the use of human-like characteristics in thinking about... deities or natural forces, and this image, this story that we have of Phil this evening, it may be a myth also for the creation of the universe. It is that some deity steps towards a pantry of structures, finds their matter and energy, and finding no. You know, that he has used up all of the goodness or has very little left, that he mixes them anyway, driven by instinct.
So perhaps the deity is making substitution pancakes, and we are the result.
And this hollowness, if we feel it, or this desire for more, is a result. So perhaps... the deity first created another universe, and this is the universe that we long for and that we hope we will reach in some after existence, some post-creation.
This is almost exactly like, I am not the greatest baker in the world, but once I made the most fabulously moist cake, and time...
It's possible that our lingering dissatisfaction with our current state is just due to the fact that the deity maybe used some lesser ingredients in our creation, and a lifetime of attempting to transcend to some higher plane is maybe just not possible due to the fact that we were used made from, you know, bleached out ingredients.
So the world itself is sort of the Walmart version of existence, and perhaps there's some higher version of existence, perhaps the IKEA version, or perhaps the Nordstrom's version, or the Crate and Barrel version.
Well, I believe rather than these capitalistic structures, it is more like, as I was going to say, the analogy with the cake, baking a cake every time, trying to get that original wonderful recipe, but every time getting an unusual result, which may be
delicious.
Have
you ever had the Amish cake?
I have not had that experience, no.
There's a type of Amish cake. It's a dessert of sorts, and it's almost like a chain letter in that the base ingredients when you make your Amish cake, you multiply the ingredients, the base ingredients, a multiple of 6 or 7. And you make 6 cakes with what you made from the original base ingredients, and then you take the remaining portion and you pass it along. So So it's almost like a chain letter of Amish goodness.
I've heard legends of these cakes, but this leads me to wonder if perhaps the universe was not created from the remains of an older universe that was inefficiently recycled. So that we have in the mixture, we have some extracts which were not intended to be there.
The continent shifted.
I think that's very likely. I mean, if you think about this, they did shift. And if you think about this Amish, well, according to some theorists, if you think about this Amish cake, the question I would have is, what are its long-run convergence properties? I mean, if you think about it, cycling through, and every time a little bit of a new ingredient gets added, eventually does it converge to this sort of supreme food substance?
Bread or marshmallow.
Or perhaps it drifts apart.
And perhaps the universe itself is going through this sort of rebirth and destruction and creation phase where each time it gets reborn, a new ingredient is added to the previous ingredients, and eventually it will converge to some marshmallow-like existence. But until it does...
Now, there are multiple schools of thought here, but there are some that believe that it's an ever-expanding universe. Could this Amish bread not be the manifestation of an ever-expanding culinary idea that could... someday colonize even the furthest reaches of the planet?
It is possible. Let's bring a new voice on the air. Caller 5, marhaban.
Hello.
Welcome, caller.
Good to be here with you, Laura. Doctor.
It is also good to have you, caller.
So, I think there is an interesting convergence happening between the recent modern culinary revolution and what I think you've all hit upon here, this notion that perhaps partially hydrogenated and high fructose matter was used in the creation of the universe.
It is an idea, but caller, as you speak, it makes me also wonder this idea of creation, of the patterning ourselves and our deity after ourselves, you know, this give and take between the story and our vision of the story, which is that perhaps our frequent cooking has been an activity that is known to have occurred for thousands of years. There are records and remains of cooking fires that extend almost as long as there have been humans with fire. And so I wonder if that activity is again simply human mirroring the creation of the universe by some deity, this cooking.
Now, not long before I called, I got a transmission from the Interstellar Brigade, Dr. Hassenfuss, and his and it would be difficult for me to communicate verbatim exactly what he had attempted to convey, but essentially it was...
What was the doctor's name?
I'm sorry?
What was that person's name?
Dr. Hassenfuss. And he was making reference to the, I believe the root of it was the fleeting nature of human memory,
What was the name of that doctor again?
Dr. Hassenfuss. Yes, and the irony, I guess, is scathing in that I can't remember exactly what the statement was.
It was probably my forgetfulness that interrupted your thought process.
Well, I actually believe that memory is shared, that all human beings actually have a sort of shared repository of memories that we can sometimes tap into, and we can actually sometimes, the lines get blurred between my memory and your memory and your mother's memory.
Right, I've had that sensation, and I think we can all identify with it, that sensation at that moment of awakening in the morning. There are times where I I feel that I'm not only coming out of a dream state. I almost feel like I'm emerging from another plane of reality. And as soon as I try to remember or capture the idea, it evaporates.
And I myself will have some sudden moment of bliss and pleasure during the day, which at first is unexplained, but after I meditate upon my experience, I'll realize that I was simply sharing the memory and the experience of someone else while they were having deep carnal relations of some sort or another.
It's impossible to capture or truly bottle or bound that feeling. Yeah, by its very nature, it is fleeting and elusive.
Well, but it also, you can experience it when you learn a new fact or you understand a new term in a better way, and then suddenly it appears everywhere around you.
Mm.
Or I think even more significantly, that one could experience it when watching a student acquire a fact or acquire an understanding, to suddenly step into that view, which you already have been stepped in and coaxing the student out of the cave of ignorance into the cave of wisdom.
Mm. Now, and this brings me to another thought. There are a lot of profound philosophical musings that have been passed down over the years. And I wonder if, even if the thought is pure, if the philosopher cannot communicate in a manner that is using proper grammar, would a deep and profound thought be dismissed simply because the grammar was horrifically incorrect in the philosopher's attempt to crystallize it into a statement to be passed down? It's almost as if, to be taken seriously as a philosopher, one must be linguistically talented as well.
Now, I don't disagree with this last statement. I think language talent is very important because it is our technology for communicating these ideas. But I think that grammar itself, a sentence may not have to be grammatical or to fit some prior mold of sentences in order to be profound or to even be understood as
right,
profound.
Right, but isn't the purest of communication nonverbal? I've had moments in my life in which just a fleeting glance, an eye contact across a room with somebody, there's almost a channel of communication that's possible that transcends the confines
of
language.
Yes, I found that these glances can be extremely powerful for communicating things which are often beyond the scope of words themselves.
Exactly.
And I've sort of tried, I've experimented with various glancing techniques, and I've further found that actually a little bit of licking can actually be more powerful than glancing. Just even to convey some deep philosophical idea, maybe a slight lick along the forearm can sometimes convey this idea in a very deep way.
Right, I was glancing and making licking motions from the front row of a gathering that I attended earlier in the week on Tuesday night, and it seemed to me that that the person that I was attempting to communicate with, maybe it was the licking, but he looked away, and it was a musician, and he refused to engage me.
But see, now, I think that because, again, this gesture was so removed from what is accepted in gestures, that it was, you achieved this strange reaction. I think that one of the more profound sentences that I have ever heard was the following, which was stated by a youth. And I think the significance also, because of the lack of grammar, the youth said to me, Dr. Jalis Sakran, he said, the great lesson is make hug, not kill. Make hug, not kill, he said. Which, of course, is a profound statement without any grammar.
Of course, it is ignoring the possibility of the bear hug, which can kill sometimes.
Mm.
this sufficiently
powerful bear hug.
Indeed, but it is against kill. So bear hug, which caused kill, would also be against the injunction.
Or the camel walk. The camel walk is also an effective means of attempt to communicate on a higher plane. But if somebody is not willing to camel walk with you, there's a possibility that you may just be
indeed
dismissed.
Let's bring another voice in. Caller, marhaban.
Hello.
Yes, caller, welcome.
Hello, greetings. It's good to hear everyone here on the radio today.
It is good to hear you on the radio, caller.
I haven't listened in quite a while, but your conversations today of communication, camel walking, and communicating things without speaking was interesting to me.
Communicating diseases.
Communicating diseases with sniffing to a rhythm.
Rhythmic sniffing. But see, also, this is with sound. But I appreciate also the wonder that we are communicating about communication that does not involve sound. And I wonder if our interaction would be more enriched if we had other avenues for communicating.
We have so many avenues for communication. They are not limited to sound. They expand all of our senses, physical and spiritual.
But I think Dr. Dallas is referring to the radio medium in particular, which does limit us to the audio-oral spectrum. But I actually believe that sometimes limiting yourself in that way, constraining yourself to a particular dimension of communication, can allow you to focus your energies in a way which otherwise would not be possible.
Much like Monet, when he limited himself to painting haystacks or lily pads, it was through repetitive attempts to work within the confines of a certain subject matter that his talents truly achieved next level, historic level.
Indeed, and I wonder if our, in scientific or learning efforts, if it is not also useful to make these sorts of restrictions. I know that mathematicians are famous for restricting their thought to a great extent to discover strange structures and the things that govern them.
Mandelbrot fracture.
Indeed, or even things as simple as a group or a ring or the Turing machine, all of which are highly constrained structures and hence are seen everywhere.
You know, it's not very widely known, but in fact, the ancient Egyptians actually constructed a very early prototype of the Turing machine.
Is that right?
Indeed, in one of the
pyramids,
one of the failed pyramids. I believe there was an attempt.
There was a simple error, though.
There was the attempt. I think one of our callers is getting a call.
He's very intriguing to have a conversation about ancient intelligence and maybe a Turing machine made out of oil.
An oil Turing machine. But it may have started out being constructed of dinosaurs.
Now, do you think that the ancient Egyptians themselves had found dinosaurs and wondered if the dinosaurs themselves had constructed a very more primitive Turing machine?
It is possible. Let's bring another voice on there to pose that question to. Caller, marhaban.
Marhaban to yourself.
So, caller, we're wondering if your view on the possibility that ancient Egyptians, believed dinosaurs to have created Turing machines.
Yeah, well, look at Horus, the god, right?
Horus.
He's half man, half lizard. His face is a lizard. And if you look at the data, in the desert of Cairo, there were lots of dinosaurs, maybe.
Yeah, I'm not too sure. I
could have been.
I thought.
Why not?
I thought Horus was not a lizard god.
I thought he was a robot.
What kind of?
A Jewish robot.
Good robot or bad robot?
Well, definitely. I mean, he was worshipped, so he had to have been predominantly a bad robot. No one remembers the good robots.
What color were his eyes? Red or green?
Most definitely red.
It's funny that in the contemporary debates about religious truth and scientific truth, we never really consider the possibility that the ancient Egyptian religion may actually have been a sort of a kernel of truth and been a true faith.
Mm-hmm.
We debate whether this religion or that religion is more correct, Scientology versus Mormonism versus Baha'i, but no one ever really seems to propose that Horus worship is the true faith, the true religion.
I think Mormonism is probably the best religion, because where else can you just get some guy walking up to people on the street saying, hey, I just got some gold plates. You want to see them? You can't. They disappeared. Sorry, but you should believe me. And then everyone was just like, you know what? I like this guy. Yeah, let's do that. Let's just go get on his caravan and go thousands of miles west to Utah.
Well, I think this shows the power of the message. And
the power of verbal and nonverbal communications as well.
Indeed, the appeal to authority when it is believed is a powerful thing. But I also noticed, I wanted to mention before my brain once again loses the grasp on these very fine threads, that Professor Levine, I appreciate the exclusion of certain New Age movements and also scientific movements, which are pure, but also may be regarded as religions. I mean, we rarely accuse someone of a foolish faith in physics.
Hmm.
I would not necessarily agree with that, especially considering the state of particle physics currently.
Well, there are those who believe that the fundamental error of mathematics was going beyond the rational number. And that as soon as we go beyond the rational number, we become irrational beings.
Indeed, I mean, it is interesting because Aurora and I were discussing this step in the standard construction of the numbers. Out of all of the steps, this is the one that is very unusual, because it relies on calculus.
Be careful.
Whereas the others, they all rely simply on algebra.
Hmm. And
I believe that this irrationality in numbers is required in order to draw out, like poison, the irrationality from our souls. If we did
not
express...
What's your favorite irrational number?
It would have to be pi squared.
There is a story of the ancient Greek philosophers, the Pythagoreans, and it's told that when the first Pythagorean first proved that the square root of 2 is not rational, he was on a ship with many other Pythagorean philosophers, and these other Pythagorean philosophers grew so upset about this finding, this possibility that there's some irrational number in the world, that they threw him overboard.
No way.
Killed him.
Indeed. And I believe certain incompleteness theorems would suggest that certain numbers are uncomputable, even.
There was no more talk about that for a while, I'm sure.
Indeed, it is a frightening thing.
Well, Gödel himself did meet a tragic end, but I think it was sort of self-committed.
Yeah. Goebbels, the German... general?
No, Gödel, the mathematician, the logician.
Gödel.
Gödel, yeah.
Gödel.
Kind of, you can wear a girdle around your waist, or you could be Gödel, the mathematician.
It
makes a lot of money.
Either which are
put the equations on a girdle and fold that outside academic conferences.
I actually think there is no R in the name.
There's
you can add one.
Well, if you're a Bostonian, I believe they would both be pronounced quite similarly. Gödel.
Gödel.
Just hawk them outside MIT or Harvard. It will go wild for that. I just recently bought a shirt. It has a rat taking its hat off, and it says, "Rats off to you."
Well, let's bring in another voice to widen our circles.
Yeah, let's bring in a new voice now.
Hello.
Yes, call it. Welcome.
Hi. I would like to find out from Aurora what she thinks about what happens when we, from a geometry-centric perspective, see the interference when lines that intersect with each other, that cross each other at different angles and produce rhombi and shapes of various sizes, triangles, diamonds, etc. Does the interference produced by those various different lines communicate to us in a way that you feel And there was a caller that brought her up earlier, the notion that we have an imperfect universe that was made from imperfect ingredients. And so my second sort of point and question and fodder for conversation is, if the creator shopped at Whole Foods for, or what we used to know as Bread and Circus, for the ingredients of the universe, do you think we would have more perfection and harmony in the way that we communicate with each other, language development, and also with the way that vapor trails form in the sky?
Well, caller, this is a very interesting question. Whether it is the integrity of the ingredients themselves that causes disharmony in our universe, or whether it is the mixture of perfect ingredients that are perhaps not harmonious in their mixture of tastes. And I would like to bring this to an sort of oral analogy. Being a vocal therapist, you can have two beautiful notes, such as a G and a G sharp, which in themselves are perfect and beautiful, smooth tones, but when mixed together, create a cacophonous sound. And this is what I believe the universe would be like. And your geometric analogy fits into this quite beautifully, with these perfect lines. These perfect lines which are perfectly straight, intersecting in different ways to create different combinations of shapes, with even sides, with odd sides, with strange angles.
Yeah, an incomprehensible rhombus.
What's really amazing about straight lines is that sometimes the line will seem straight, but when viewed through a distortion, perhaps a glass of water or a stabbed eye or extreme sleepiness, the line will appear to curve and then become straight again and then curve and become straight again, leading to this sort of paradox of straightness and unstraightness simultaneously.
Well, and this begs the question, are we really seeing straight when we look at lines?
Indeed, these are great challenges. And you know, if you were to place a straight line on a shirt which had ripples, it would no longer appear straight.
I was in Whole Foods yesterday, and I was looking for some macaroni salad, and behind the counter, they were charging $6.99 for the macaroni salad. And in the freezer case, or the refrigerated case, where it was prepared and already portioned out, it was $3.99 for a pound. And I couldn't understand this. It was some serious irrational numbers for what looked to be very competitively the same matter.
I see some arbitrage opportunities there, perhaps for a hedge fund.
I invested heavily in the macaroni salad in the refrigerated case.
Caller, I'd like to address this from a resonance point of view, which is that once you freeze a material, you introduce a periodic crystal, which can cause different waveforms, which can disturb your interaction with the food. So frozen foods are not always as acceptable as their fresh counterparts.
So I've just been notified that we have a caller waiting. Let's see if we can bring that through. Caller, are you with us?
Yes.
Welcome, caller.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to be back again. I think that this whole subject is so over-intellectualized that it's just...
What do you mean by over-intellectualized?
I think that really, if we went back to worshiping the sun, it would be so simple. We could just worship twice a day. And we could get rid of all the intellectualizing, and we could really appreciate where life comes from, and we could realize that we've created God in our likeness.
We did that, though. We created the Horus robot with the red eyes. The ancient Egyptians did that. They created a Turing machine that was made out of myrrh. And sooner or later, these other guys on a boat figured out that numbers might not all be rational. So they threw them overboard. And then we were all at Whole Foods pondering why macaroni salad costs two different prices when it's exactly alike.
But I wonder about the sun.
If you make it at home, it's even cheaper. But really, the sun would be a very good subject for our...
I do. I mean, my own personal problem with the sun worship is that I am very fair-skinned. And so I tend to get burned by the sun, and so I sometimes feel a little anger.
You personally have an issue with the sun.
I feel anger with the sun, and I wonder if that's related to my anger with God in some way, with nature itself.
Like those really good tomatoes.
Well, I could accept sun worship so long as there would be a subgroup that could meet maybe bimonthly for moon worship also.
So that there is an equal attention given to each of the celestial bodies. But I think there is something very important and intellectually worthwhile about a God that is invisible and that is omnipresent, because the sun really is just in one place. And to a person who has been imprisoned or perhaps digging in a cave for 1,000 years or swimming underwater, who is no longer seeing the sun, it becomes simply another abstraction, a thing that I'm told exists but which I have never seen.
But given that the sun is the source of nourishment for all of our existence, and in fact we can see it and we can experience its rays directly...
Well, see, now, I actually think this is inaccurate. There are living beings alive who live from the warmth that is deep within the earth. And so a more precise statement is that there is some energetic explosion which is the source for both the sun and for the planet's warmth. And so it is this which is the source of all life.
Well, and to expand this... There is a source that caused the sun to come about, and in the end we are left to worship the concept of energy itself, which is truly energy transfer is what causes the plants to grow and to nourish us.
And I think we actually can cause energy transfer between our souls, between our essences, when we interact with each other as human beings. And I think this is part of why we're on this planet, why we're here, is to transfer this energy in a more harmonious way and to achieve greater net harmony of all humankind and all creation together.
Well, and our physical forms, I believe, is just another manifestation of that energy, an expression of that energy in a different way, and that we can somehow release ourselves from our bodies and enhance our spiritual energies, and this is what we do when we meditate.
Yes, I could play that statement over and over every morning, Aurora, and that would be so true.
When the sun's coming up.
Well, this I guess begs the question of, in a place like Boston, right now it's all very well to say that we worship the sun, given that we see it every day, but when the long, cold days of the winter come upon us, which they will come.
Oh, there comes the old faith thing.
Then what do we do?
I myself live here in Seattle, Washington, and we do not see the sun for 9 months of the year behind clouds and rain, and someday don't know if it's ever going to come back.
So can we store the warmth of the sun internally, perhaps, and allow that to radiate out from within?
I do that through dance, pelvic motions, Sometimes if I have a recorded sound of a drum, I will dance the dance of the sun.
I believe that dances are wonderful to express so many of the emotions that the things around us give us. And the sun is one of those things that allow us to feel so joyful and as if we are in love with the world. And we can feel this after we've experienced these long, horrendous winters.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the good thing about the Boston winter is that it sort of forces us to find our happiness within ourselves instead of getting our happiness from some external radiation source.
Indeed, and this is something I find so valuable, actually, because it makes the person, again, contain within himself his palace, his deity, and his existence, which is where the existence does ultimately reside. And in spite of the temporary nature of so many things, including the time which has been given to us in the show, we can maintain these existences within us constantly.
This is true. Without the show every Friday evening, there might not be any sun at all anymore.
Indeed.
I'm going to cry.
I'm so sorry, all callers. Sorry that the time, again, has conspired.
Good night.
Namaste.
Good evening. Thank you again, and we'll talk again soon, I'm sure.
Thank you, both callers, and thank you to the many, many callers that we could not get to this evening. Thanks, of course, to Professor Levine.
Thank you.
And to Aurora.
Good night.
I am Dr. Jalis Sakran here on Music for Human. Music for Human is New Age Talk Radio with an emphasis on you. We are here every Friday at 7 p.m. We enjoy almonds, which appear to be small pieces of wood, here on WMBR Cambridge 88.1 FM. Stay tuned for Hipster Happy Hour. Ma'a salama.
For safety.
Number one.
Cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two.
Look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three.
Cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four.
Cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians in unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
Head to toe, rayon, don't light a match. We look good and we're starting from scratch. Going to a place that never existed and probably never will, yeah. Oh, blue white basement on the throw down. Autonomous zone within the lights. And we're well enough alone to leave your contact at home and leave your party at the door.
Hi, and welcome once again to Hipster Happy Hour. Insert ironic catchphrase here. This is your host, Stiegmeister J, or just the Stiegmeister, if you prefer. Tonight, I actually do have a theme instead of the eclectic mess that was last time. I call tonight's playlist, Oh God, the Noise. So, to kick things off appropriately, here's Lightning Bolt.